All right, questions and comments before we move along to our next session. Well, I've changed the picture here. It's not a very large picture because it's losing focus rapidly as I blow it up. But it's a poster from the movie State and Maine, which was written by David Mamet and directed by David Mamet, and is a satire on Hollywood and the process of movie making. I'm sorry? And I just put it up because, of course, we're concluding our discussion of his book, The Secret Knowledge. So what ultimately is the message of this book and why?
Take a close look at what you believe, what you have believed since childhood, and see if you're following an ideology.
Okay.
You need to break away from it.
A theology, an ideology, any set of ideas defined by somebody else demanding allegiance to them is something that you need to... In order to think, we have to challenge every assumption we've ever made. Is it useful to me? Is it counterproductive? Other summary statements here.
What's sort of the same thing, but it's basically leading a self-examined life.
Okay. Leading a self-examined life. Very good. The... Mamet indicates that logic is entirely on the side of conservative thought, something he didn't understand until very recently, and yet liberals often refuse to recognize this truth even when they understand it. Why is this? Well, go ahead. No, that's not what he says. On page 214, let me... read a passage here. Given a perception that the greater possibility of happiness for the greatest number lies in conservative rather than liberal principles, why is the transition to the first from the second difficult? One may reason, as I and many readers have, with honest, intelligent, moral, liberal friends who may, in one instance after another, grant the validity of one's conservative theses and acknowledge the discrepancy between their own actions and their voting habits, yet vote not only Democratic but proclaim that nothing on earth can induce them to do otherwise. Why? It means leaving the group. It means leaving the group. Having identified with a group for 50 years, they become frozen and unable to move, unable to break the chains of the ideology or the theology. And you see, this is what I'm getting at when I say, when I ask the question, has Nancy Pelosi ever thought in her life? Of course not. She's just done what other members of her family did before. And she has no courage to leave the group, even if she understood differently. And we get put into boxes. And this is why Black America votes 90% Democratic. They do not want to leave the group. They have erroneously identified Democrats as their saviors, even though it's Democrats that have held them back. I was listening a bit to Rush on the way to the post office at lunch, and Rush was talking about the fact that it was Woodrow Wilson, the Democrat president, who instigated segregation in the military during World War I, and it was only in order to end that, Harry Truman had to act unilaterally by executive order. He couldn't submit the request to Congress because the so-called Dixiecrats would have blocked any effort to desegregate the military. And in spite of this, which should be known American history, the black race, those people in the black population of this country, monolithically vote Democrat, even though the Democrats have never been their friend. They've been their masters. They don't want to leave the group. They identify with the group. They find satisfaction with the group. Did you have a point?
Oh, just a couple of examples of that would be Zell Miller and Joe Lieberman.
Right.
I mean, it's clearly not the party they originally joined, and yet they can't leave it.
Yeah. There's a number of excellent points like this throughout the book. Mamet, yes, go ahead.
It was interesting for me in that I grew up with parents who were Democratic, and I kind of hung on to, although I was voting basically Republican most of the time, I was holding on to my Democratic registration. And I saw my father do the same thing. So it took me a while to make the shift.
Sure.
So I identify with leaving the group.
Yep. Anybody who has knows how difficult it is. Family members will express utter bewilderment at why you are leaving the family group and the larger cultural group. Now, I very much like it when Mamet says that he would define the political situation as, don't let the other fellow piss on your back and tell you it's rain. We have to fight in order to establish the conservative principles in this country. We have to fight the media. The media is constantly telling us that it's raining when they're pissing on our backs. And we have to take that, we have to develop that attitude of understanding that virtually everything the media tells us is distorted, twisted, perverted. Just last night, we were watching, we watched maybe 2 minutes worth of the news before turning out the lights. You would think you'd be safe, but the anchor had to say, the stock market dropped 520 points during the day, and people throughout the country lost trillions of dollars of assets. Now, that's called pissing on your back and saying it's raining. Nobody lost trillions of dollars of assets. In one day's time, the value of those assets may have dropped, but today they're back up 490 points when I checked over the break. Which means that almost everything, maybe by the end of the day, it'll be higher, maybe it'll be lower. So what? It averages out over a long period of time. Making a dramatic, sweeping statement like 401k has lost trillions of dollars of value in a single day is like throwing a bomb into the middle of an auditorium. At least a stink bomb. All it's designed to do is incite fear and panic. There was no news element in it. It was judgmental. It was biased. It was slanderous, in fact. And it didn't do anything. It's like the whole nonsense in the lead up to the debt ceiling bit. All it was for day after day was the U.S. has to prevent default. If we don't raise the debt ceiling, there will be default. And everybody knows that the annual requirement for satisfying the debt interest is $300 billion, and we take in $2.3 trillion. We take in 8 times the amount of money from taxes that is necessary to avoid defaulting on any foreign obligation. And the dirty little secret is that 75% of that debt is owned by Americans.
It's rolled over.
It's called treasury bonds and so on. And as Rose just pointed out, it's rolled over. So it would only be a problem if everybody in this country decided to cash in their savings bonds on the same day and their treasuries and so on. Then there might be a little bit of a run on the banks or something. But it doesn't happen because good citizens aren't going to do that. So it's very, very important. I think this is probably the most profound thing he said. Don't let anybody piss on your back and tell you it's raining. You develop your own insight into what's going on in the country. Yes. Well, I don't think anything guarantees profits. If profit is guaranteed, then there's no risk. And if there's no risk, there's no potential for gain. Our whole life is structured on taking a risk, making an investment, running the possibility that you may lose it, but in the long run, building up wealth that you couldn't build any other way, because you're willing to take a risk, make an investment, and help the country grow, help the economy grow. And that principle is so fundamental, and so few people understand it because it's never taught in our school system. It's never taught in high school. It's never taught in college. It is the principle of capitalism, and it's also very much the principle of growth at the divine level. Well, there's no question that any intelligent person will find what they consider to be the least risky form of investment to shelter their money. But they're still putting it into the overall enterprise and the overall economy so that things develop, and that's the important point. The Mamet hammers home the point that conservatives work to make life better, and, of course, enjoy the fruits of their labor. Liberals tout uselessness, in his terms, and want society to redress the wrong they suffer by dint of their uselessness. It's a powerful argument. We saw this on the news the other night, rioting in Britain, and as I mentioned this morning, they interviewed one person who said, this is the way we get back at the rich. He was admitting his uselessness and his powerlessness except through destructiveness. And that is the sign of a society in the process of collapsing, a great society collapsing.
You know what? At the same time, there was a group that was facing right up to the screen, one of those protecting
right.
Family. I mean, it was almost exciting to hear him say, they will not get away with this. I will defend my family, my property to the death.
Sure.
I've had it all.
Right. Well, that's basically the backlash always that ends liberalism, because is what happened in Wisconsin. They thought they had, were too clever by half by staging this recall, and the people stood up and said, no, we're not going to recall these people. They did what we elected them to do. Oh, absolutely.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah. Well, he says that he wouldn't vote for somebody because of their purity. He wants people who are able to see what's in the best interest of the greatest group. He just doesn't want them to lie to him. He would rather vote for somebody that he knows is lying to him, because he understands that the person has the stamina or the moxie or whatever to lie when it's necessary to foreign powers. And but he savages the well, in fact, this passage is on page 217 under the chapter "Who does one think he is?" And one being Obama. "I can forgive someone who lies, but if he can't think on his feet, he has no business representing my interests. If he can't lie to me, how can I expect him to lie on my behalf to the other guy?" This is pragmatic. This is not very idealistic, but it's very pragmatic. He had just written the paragraph, "I was born in Hyde Park and grew up on the south side of Chicago. I hold no brief against someone who is not interested in sports, but I could never trust someone who claimed such an interest in order to advance his own agenda, and then could neither name a member, pastor, or president of his self-apostrophized home team, nor correctly pronounce the name of their ballpark." And his footnote is, President Obama, in a radio interview at a ballpark, was asked if he, as a Chicagoan, preferred the Sox or the Cubs. He claimed he was a Sox fan, twice mispronounced the name of Comiskey Park, twice referred to the umpire as the judge, and asked for his, when asked for his favorite White Sox pastor or president, could not come up with one name. Sigh. The nothing skewers Obama's phoniness and pretense more than that. It explains why he wasn't able to throw out the first pitch and get it over the plate. It bounced about 20 feet in front of him. His own daughters could have thrown the ball better than that. So it's that kind of exposure here that is going on in this book.
They're a basketball family, not baseball.
Yeah. Well, he claimed to be a baseball fan. That's the... If he come out and said, "I know nothing about baseball and don't care," Mame would have said, "Well, that was honest." I like his little anecdote in the chapter "The Small Refrigerator." "My daughter had an heiress in her elementary school class. The two were discussing their various bedtimes, and the heiress said that every evening at 10 o'clock she went to the small refrigerator in her room and took out her usual snack, fresh berries and organic yogurt dripped with honey. My daughter asked, 'Who puts it there?' The heiress paused for a while and said, 'I don't know.'" It's like, how do the rich become rich? I don't know. How does the government get its money? I don't know. Well, so conservatives work to make life better, and liberals champion uselessness. He wraps up his argument by drawing a distinction between government and the individual. The individual expects government to establish and maintain order. Period. To do this, government must be based on a workable set of ethics. Mame admires the Judeo-Christian basis of our system and argues that it is this core that has made the country great. Take away the core, the country collapses. And he strongly makes the point, liberalism is based on atheism. It seeks liberty from law, not through law. It seeks to replace justice with social justice, meaning what the liberal believes to be fair. But this erodes stability because no one can ever be certain how a judge might rule in a society that embraces social justice. And I think he's absolutely brilliant when he talks about if any one of us had a case before a court, we would want a jury of our peers, a jury of plumbers and grocery store workers and cab drivers and whatever. People like us, not experts. And the idea that experts come in, each side brings in an expert to testify, he says the average jury just blows it away because one expert says yay and the other says nay, and they contradict each other, and it's just so much kabuki theater. Justice is, he correctly points out that one of the fundamental characteristics of our society is the jury trial, a trial by our peers, and not by a judge, not by the government, but by our peers. For society to be orderly, we must accept the likelihood that it will not always rule or govern fairly. Think about that. For society to be orderly, we must accept the likelihood that it will not always rule wisely or govern fairly. It's a group of ordinary people trying to, as he said, the federal government is nothing but your local zoning board writ large. The jury system is nothing but ordinary people coming together and using their common sense to adjudicate. That is the ideal of self-government. And we have to understand that good-hearted people sometimes make mistakes. And yet, there was a poll that came out yesterday. Who do you think the most hated person in America is? You saw the same poll. Casey Anthony. We know virtually nothing about Casey Anthony except the misinformation we got from a press dedicated to pissing on us and saying that it's rain. But all these people throughout America hate Casey Anthony. And that's an indictment of public intelligence. It indicates a complete lack of understanding that justice was served. Now let's get on with the next chapter of life. May not have been served well, but it's not up to us to worry about that. The system of government worked. Live with it. The people here in Atlanta who think it is unfair that the city's infrastructure is collapsing have, of course, been infected by liberalism. They fail to recognize that they elected people who diverted funds from repairing bridges and water pipes and whatever into bigger welfare payments, housing for the poor, all in the name of fairness and social justice. They came in and proudly said that they were going to demonstrate what local government could do, and they bankrupted it. So there isn't any money left over to repair bridges or roads. Fortunately, we live in the South where there aren't a whole lot of potholes. But Atlanta doesn't have the money. And you know what? Atlanta is the biggest metropolitan area in the South. The city of Atlanta has 125,000 less residents than the city of Columbus, Ohio. Because, first of all, it's landlocked by all the suburbs around it, and they're individual cities of their own right, so Atlanta can't expand. But secondly, the most common sight in Atlanta is an empty building. The erstwhile population of Atlanta 40, 50 years ago has moved out to Gwinnett County, to DeKalb County, to anywhere except the the inner city because the city has done such a poor job of maintaining its infrastructure. It's very difficult to run a business profitably in Atlanta, and so businesses have flown to the suburbs. They're still in the metro Atlanta area. They still think of themselves as Atlantans, but the population of Atlanta is maybe 70% of Columbus, Ohio. These people don't understand what they've done. They are the ones that have created the decay in the city that they now complain about. And you've never seen racism until you witnessed it in a race for mayor of Atlanta. The only people running, of course, are blacks. And there's one black calling the other black a racist, because that's the only way they know how to get elected. You're a bigger racist. I was there with Martin Luther King Jr. I've got credentials. You don't. Well, that's the uselessness of liberalism. Can you recognize similar attitudes in modern society that are the direct result of the infection of mass consciousness by liberalism? Anybody?
Say that again, please.
Can you recognize similar attitudes in modern society that are the direct result of the infection of mass consciousness by liberal ideas?
Carl?
Yes.
When I was at the university, the big thing, the big word that we heard was diversity.
Sure. Uh-huh. Right. The point I'm getting at here is this is not just a book for liberals to figure out that they're up the wrong, barking up the wrong tree. This is a book for all of us, conservatives, liberals alike, to understand how much the warp and fabric of mass thinking has been corrupted by liberalism. And that we need to restore common sense to our thought process.
Well, I was thinking of women, the role of women, and this new, that all the feminists and all the expenses will be just free. We're bringing women backwards rather than forwards. And I mean, I really do believe that this, especially for young adults, this birth control is like an invitation.
Right. Well, once it becomes aware that there's a plague of sexual diseases because of indiscriminate sex protected by birth control pills, there will have to be some reevaluation.
This is the opposite of this whole concept.
Yes, yes, the liberated woman is enslaved by her liberation.
That doesn't even make sense with the liberal stand, viewpoint.
I understand. I want to end our discussion of Mamet by quoting a couple of paragraphs on page 152. He says, "Rabbinical thought holds that all sins are the sin of the golden calf. Moses told the Jews to wait as he was ascending the mountain to talk with God. The Jews did not wait, but instead built a golden image and worshipped it. But note that, though we understand their sin, and may accept indeed that it is the type of all sin, it was committed while Moses was yet undescended from the mountain, that is, before the Jews even received the law. That is to say, they held in their hearts some conscience, some knowledge of the divine which caused them, on discovery of their act, shame at what they, even uninstructed, understood as a transgression. All healthy people have a conscience. Those born without it are known as psychopaths and treated, for all our philosophical sophistication, as monsters. the implication here is that liberalism has stripped away the sense of sin against the spirit of America and unleashed monstrous thoughts in our public discourse. And so it's the duty of every thinking person to go back and root out what Bill has talked about as the influx of communist thought and socialist thought from Europe, root out any traces of what Mamet refers to as uselessness, the theory of uselessness, root out the idea of, well, don't you care? The idea that liberalism is compassion automatically and that Republicans are mean-spirited. We have to root out all this nonsense, all this pedophagy in order to think clearly. Okay. All right, it's 4 o'clock, and what does that mean? It means it's time for oral presentations. It's time I can lean back and let you teach the class about the various laws as I assigned them for your special interest project. So we'll use the same sequence as we've done before for the oral presentations. Mary, I assigned you the law of economy. You're on.
All right, the law of economy is the cosmic law governing the matter aspect of manifestation, method of the distribution of matter. It characterizes the work of the very logos, the entities who are embodied in its will, as well as each of its universe. It is the third aspect, or the law aspect, of the activities of those entities who are his expressions of the third person of the Trinity.
Okay.
The law governing the scattering of atoms of matter and their dissociation from one another. So it has to do with the downward evolution, the downward flow of energy.
All right.
Other ways of describing it is exhibit dissociation, one from the other, wide distribution, vibratory rhythm, heterogeneities, and rotary action. So these are all defining actions or behaviors of this energy. It causes matter always to follow the movement to existence. It is the basis of the separative action of atomic matter, which is the opposite. Spirit, as I said, the stage of involution, separation of that, where the one becoming the many, think of creation as dividing into the seven planes. I mean, I'm just saying what I've selected is the seven grains of matter, the seven grains. This law also has several subsidiary laws which govern its effects on the different grades of matter. They are vibration, which has to do with keynotes. And I'm going to have, there's two aspects of this that I'm going to talk about because there's just so much information. Also, adaptation, which has to do with this repulsion, which just means that in this phase, the atoms steer away from each other. Govern our embrace. What have been understood my thought of God. I don't know why this is called the heresy, because if it's part of creation, I have lots of questions. I mean, to me, this whole law is describing the downflow of this energy, and as it comes down to the most dense point, it separates. So the negative outcome of this could be that the fires of destruction within our civilization, just as the Atlantean civilization said to our folks, the challenge is to develop. Was the Atlantean, that was the law of the tides. We are the law of cleavage, and when following would be the law of working understanding. So even though this is the energy of dissociation, the ultimate goal is that we learn how to build these connecting bridges and to synthesize. And the third aspect is also this aspect of activity, which I think at this point in time symbolizes our intellect, and our goal is to raise this to the level of intuition. And these two subsidiary goals, one that I thought was so interesting, the first one is that of migration. And that deals with the keynote or measure of the matter of each being. And when I most of my stuff would be pleasant. And there was a lovely interpretation of that great word that deals with the 100 years of Brahma, or persists in reverberation throughout the solar system. Each letter, with a sequence of four sounds, makes up a vibration or note of Brahma, which is the intelligence aspect dominant in matter. So we are talking about matter with this also intelligence, five sounds brings to mind the mystery of the pentagon, the principle of mind, and when sounded forth on the right note, the each occupied our note, and that goes on and on and on, it's just the individual planet, all beings have to find their note. When sounded forth on the right note, it gives the key to the inwardness of matter, and also to its control. This control will be based on the right interpretation of the law of the mind. When the sense of hearing on all the planes is perfected, brought about by this law of the mind and rightly understood, the three great words will be understood. The number will utter them in its own truth. In his own sound, achieving sudden realization of his essential identity in those words. A sound of matter or Brahma peels forth in his ears on all the planets. He will see all forms as illusion and will be free, knowing himself as illusion. And then the other aspect that I thought was really fascinating was that the numbers 3 and 5, 3 and 7, which I'm sure this is where I got this, they're very essential. The third is the activity aspect, controls the laws of disintegration and death on the third and seventh planes. And I'm going like, okay, what is all this thing about disintegration, sacrifice, and death? Ray 7 is connected to Ray 7. Ray 3, intelligence. Ray 7, law and order. So it's the ray of law and order. It controls life in the mineral world, but also in the final stages of the involutionary light, at the point where the upward turn of evolution is made. So this lowest plane of all, even though it's the most densest, it's also here for the transition. all periods of transition are periods of destruction and building of forms and shattering of old order and newer and better chalices of life. Reflection on physical plane of power and activity as it is. I mean, it was, to me, I'm seeing this as divine energy, evolution coming down, breaking apart into atomic energy, quantum energy, and it's separate. It's moving in a circular movement, but it's going in its own direction. And as it hits the bottom, it's a point of not transformation, but a point of turning and preparing for the term journey. And sound is important that each of us at some point is looking at our own.
Okay. Good. Now, does anybody have any questions for Mary before we go on? The idea here is that as matter descends, as you pointed out, as it descends from level to level, is always a single point of oneness that splits and fragmentizes and creates an infinite number of points at the lower level. And then it's repeated over and over again. So that while there can be an infinite number of thoughts, they can be traced back to a single source. And in that source, you discover oneness and unity, hence economy. It's much more economical to work from the point of the single source than the diversity that's been created, generated. Good. All right, very good. I thank you for that. Louise, you're up next with the law of cause and effect. Yes, please.
Explains how man is intended for the culturally determined his own destiny and create his causes while working with his own soul and will. He is meant to have free will and not given a circumstance, but an act of personal values which determine his course of actions in life. This attitude is very different from some people who believe they must submit to the will of God and accept their limited circumstances for good or bad. An example of this would be the Christian Science. States that only the human beings who are consciously using their mind power are any causes really being generated. All causes being initiated by a mind of some kind thinking clearly, positive of thinkers. Our solar system is a thought form and is one having real existence, just as long as thought persists. All thoughts are part of a divine stream. The mass of people do not think, and so they cannot generate causes that produce any effects. In discussing the education of the New Age, it talks about that law of cause and effect must be taught to help humanity recognize that behind all happenings and events, there exists a world of energies. These energies are diverse and complex, but will all move and work under the law of cause and effect. This sort of summarizes it all. The method used in the educational system is the law of cause and effect, which the Bible would describe as you sow, so shall you reap. In terms of modern physics, the law of cause and effect could be summarized as, for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. Every thought and deed sets a cause that leads to certain effects for better or for worse. By understanding and working within this impersonal law, we learn to make better choices. Gradually take control of our destiny through experiencing all that life in this world has to offer. We ultimately acquire that mastery over ourselves and become perfect human beings, manifesting the divinity dwelling in each of us.
Very good. Anybody have any questions about the law of cause and effect for Louise? Okay, very good, Louise. Our next one is Mimi telling us about the law of evolution.
Okay.
Okay.
The law of evolution. Okay. In beginning my readings, I first sought to understand the term law. D.K. wrote that laws are only the unalterable conditions brought about by the activity, the orientation, and the decisive thoughts of the one in whom we live and move and have our being. It is written in Discipleship in the New Age 2 that at this time the eye of his direction is turned toward a needy and waiting world, and particularly toward the large number of people who hold within themselves the potencies of discipleship. They are the hope of the world. We are instructed in the book The Rays and the Initiations that from the exoteric angle, evolution means growth and development. This is the common connotation which people think of when they hear the term. In this respect, evolution is confined primarily to the form world. However, from the esoteric angle, evolution means a steadily increasing sensitivity to light and illumination. It is interesting to note that a master may not possess all possible exoteric knowledge, but truly he doesn't need it because he has evolved and is on the way of light. D.K. instructs that in the total evolution of the spiritual man through many physical incarnations, process is simply one of expanding consciousness and of attaining, sequentially and stage by stage, an ever more inclusive awareness. It is a fact that the symbolism that we associate with the Antahkarana and have learned recently in Carl's class will become reality. One aspect of evolution that we are meant is that we are meant to create that which will bridge the gap between the lower mind and the abstract mind. The higher mind, which is the lowest aspect of the spiritual triad, is said to serve as a door which admits the consciousness of the soul-infused personality into a higher realm of contact and awareness. The task of building the Antahkarana is, in truth, the planned and conscious effort to project the focused thought of the spiritual man from the lower mental plane into areas of awareness already developed and enlightened by the soul. This makes him increasingly sensitive to the focused activity of the world of higher spiritual realities, the world of the masters, of the spiritual triad, and finally of Shambhala. The higher way of evolution is said to be far simpler than the lower way. That is, the teaching on the significance and the meaning of the Antahkarana, which is the first criterion of our soul-infused personality acting as a unitary being, is simpler than the relating to the personality in the three worlds of human evolution. Through the practice of group meditation, we should be able to develop that conscious, focused attitude which can be regarded as reflection. The consciousness is held steady in the light. The Antahkarana is a realization to the disciple, and the mind is oriented toward the spiritual triad. A stream of ascending energy is built, which is colored by the man's life qualities and the developing ray characteristics. Along that stream, the developing ray characteristics can pass at will. The New Testament mentions the things of spirit. This is what the disciple will increasingly be able to register as he evolves. As he evolves, he will acquire the faculty to penetrate into the world of the hierarchy and to reach the door to the way of the higher evolution. He will at the same time function in the three worlds as a serving disciple. As we build the Antahkarana, the thought projection process or exercise becomes a part of your normal state of mind, serving to focus us upon the mental plane, withdrawing our attention from the world of the emotions, from desire and aspiration, and placing us upon the lighted point, upon the lighted way, where, as DK writes, light may shine and show a star which shines above the brow of the initiate. Meditation is the major creative agent in the universe and is our means of evolving spiritually. There are seven sources of meditative activity: the planetary logos himself, the group which is the higher correspondence of the Nirman Kayas, Shambhala, here is known and embodied the purpose of the planetary logos, the divine contemplatives, the hierarchy of the masters, and this group which stands midway between Shambhala and humanity. The hierarchy is subject to impression from Shambhala, and then they act as agents for the impression of humanity. They embody and express the love aspect of the divine purpose. They wield, direct, and control the law of attraction, the motivating energy which swings the law of evolution into activity in the three worlds. They work through directed meditation. Each ashram is a center of meditation to which every disciple, initiate, and master contributes. The individual and group meditations of disciples, if of an adequate nature and quality, will be absorbed into and become part of the ashramic meditation. The theme of the hierarchical meditation is the plan, as it embodies the divine purpose. There are also the new group of world servers. These are servers to the hierarchy, and then this group works through another group, the men and women of goodwill. There is also humanity itself, which is said to be in a state of unconscious meditation at all times. All that is created by meditation, by desire merging with transient thought the transient thought becoming clear thinking, and eventually abstract and transcendent thought. There are three major groups of thinkers and three other groups of intensive creative thinkers, all responsible for and dedicated to the comprehension of the divine purpose as it works out through the spiritual hierarchical plan. This is applied under the law of evolution to humanity and through humanity to the subhuman kingdoms in nature. From the human family, all divine lives and beings have come. In humanity, the creative process is constantly working, and into humanity, all subhuman lives must eventually proceed. The new age will bring in a civilization and culture different to anything known. All civilizations and cultures are externalizations of the potent, vibrating, and planned activity of the world initiates and disciples who constitute the hierarchy of the time. Their plans, their thinking, and their living potency pour out ceaselessly and affect the consciousness of their disciples. The disciples then step down the inflowing energy so that the thinkers and idealists can grasp the new emerging truths more accurately. Eventually, the truths thus grasped change the consciousness of humanity as a whole and raise it. All this can be traced back to the group of initiates upon the inner side, who thus serve their fellow men and carry forward, consciously and with intent, the law of evolution. While doing this, they are prepared to tread the way of higher evolution. This way of higher evolution is related to the spiritual condition and purpose of the monad. The entire story of evolution is covered in the words, "The initiate knows because he works." The Christ said, "If any man shall do his will, he shall know." Under the occult law, doing ever precedes knowledge, because knowledge is gained through experiment and experience. The disciple or aspirant works always in the dark, particularly in the early stages of his unfoldment. He follows a deep and hidden instinct towards right activity. By that hard and persistent performance of duty, under the pressure of consciousness at first, under the impulse of his awakening soul, and under the influences of the Master, he moves forward from darkness to light. He discovers that obedience to his spiritual instincts leads him inevitably into the realm of knowledge, and that knowledge, when acquired, is transformed eventually into wisdom. He then becomes a master and walks no longer in the dark. And revelation, which is closely connected to evolution, continues. You asked about us relating it to our lives, and I thought that this has been a year of major beacons on the path of evolution. The classes as the love of God, the Antikorana, self-determination, readings of In the Beginning, the above the mean writings, and this, from which we are now involved, Woven Ultra.
Very good. Any questions for me?
Mimi, I was just wondering, I know when I was reading on sound, you said that there comes a point, no matter how much you want to evolve, our bodies are not equipped. In other words, if we heard all the sounds of the universe, we would be destroyed.
Sure.
And is there something that you read, and there are no animals, and there's a certain progression, like soul, where some animals may cross over. Basically, they move as a group. Is there a point with humanity that we more or less move on our own will, our own desire, our own participation, other than, as I said, for the hearing, there might be some things that we might not have wanted, and wait until evolution is something outside of our own will.
I don't know what your question is. I heard everything that you had to say, but what is your question?
Well, here, so we don't get too unraveled, other people are waiting. Let me just briefly answer this. And that is that humanity, you're working with a little bit of a false assumption there, Mary. humanity does move forward as a group. It's unseen. Within that, we have our own individual growth and whatnot, but keep in mind that the real growth occurs at the level of the soul, not the personality. And that real growth occurring at the level of the soul is group. That's why we have such an emphasis on forming groups at this point. And so let's leave it at that. That's a great question, but we could go for hours exploring that. And I'd like to keep our focus. Very good. Thank you, Mimi. Nancy, the law of sacrifice.
I really couldn't write it all out.
That's all right. No excuses. Just go ahead. Did you bring us a lamb or a goat?
A rabbit.
Oh, no.
Oh, the sacrificial rabbit.
I first went to the secret doctrine, and at the footnote, I found finding the real meaning of the word SACR, from which sacred and sacrament are derived. Letters, and that it's purely phallic. And so I went to the dictionary of symbols and I found the symbol of fecundity of sacrifice, which is an engraving from 1512. You can find it on Google, you can get the picture online, and it's the Christ on a tree. There's vines coming down with fruit, and people are taking off the fruit at the bottom and helping themselves. So I guess there's something to the fecundity of sacrifice. And I went online to trust and got some information. And then the first one, actually, even though they referred to the good books, I couldn't find the law of sacrifice in the book. It was online. So the law of sacrifice is the law of those who choose to die. And the ray energy, they say, is the outpouring fourth ray. And on the site, they called it the at-warning energy. And this law is one of the first inner subjective laws to express itself consciously. And then it goes on to explain the significance of this law is the impulse of giving, and that the solar deity gives his life to the universe. And it goes on down, it's throughout nature. The cosmic deity has done the same. Cosmic Christ was crucified on the cross of matter, and the sacrifice gives an opportunity to all the lives in all the created world. And the Christ sacrifice is something I looked up and I found in the Hidden Side of Things, the confirmation that the church that celebrates the Eucharist as a daily repetition of the sacrifice of the Christ. But the author goes on to explain that the Christ, the sacrifice of the Christ means the descent into matter, the outpouring of the second aspect of deity, and it's the that he actually his incarnation is the sacrifice on the cross. And that I think goes on to explain how music, which is interesting, can be used to help the priest perform his sacrament to bring in the force of it, which is interesting because it's supposed to be, have to be a fourth ray sort of thing. And then when the Bible, the Tarot, the idea of sacrifice and how it applies on down, Max Kendall has said that an elder brother will only grasp my extended hand when I extend my hand to a younger one coming behind me. And So this is the only way to progress is by giving help and by giving. And then in the Secret Ages, secret teachings of all ages, I found a table of items which is a philosophy of sacrifice, rites, and ceremony, system of the occult. And it's a lot of the very interesting thing, very highly complicated, and of course I can't read it. And this shows that it starts by talking how Plato was initiated. So I, in this, in Egypt, which, I mean, not too many people refer to that, but I would guess being in this book is true. And so he, his teachings would be also a sacrifice. And I think that in our daily life that it would be for us to spread sacrifices, making life sacred. So I read in The Life of Spirit, Volume 3, that essay, and I think we are all familiar with it, but Carl Doppler, Dr. Lightman has compared making life sacred with electricity and how we need to act. Electricity is something that's always been around, but it's something we need to use to put in. It's not something we believe or just watch it. We harness it, we put it to use. And you do that with spirit too, and that's how you make life sacred. You have to bring it down, you have to act on it, and that's how we serve the plan of God.
Okay. Good. Any questions for Nancy? Well, all right. Very good. Thank you, Nancy. Let's go on. Rose and the story of the law of magnetism.
God's nature is love. It is an irresistible force that courses through all life, mineral, vegetable, plant, and human kingdoms. As each kingdom responds, it is drawn magnetically to this radiating force and eventually evolves and passes into the next kingdom. Part of humanity's assignment is to cultivate life on Earth. The task is to develop a responsiveness to the best within any form, to nurture and draw it forth. The nurturing of the lower kingdoms encourages aspiration and the impulse to grow, to evolve. In this way, we learn to express God's love. We become a channel for radiating His love while magnetically drawing up that which is able to respond. As humanity acts as a relaying channel of God's love to the lower kingdoms, it is being drawn magnetically, it is being drawn upward by a magnetic pull of the energy of spirit, the fifth kingdom. As the principle states, the higher meets the lower and remains the higher. In humanity, the magnetic attraction of friendship is based on mutual sharing of common ideals, goals, values, and goodwill. Throughout our many incarnations, this bond causes us to reunite with one another as our paths of destiny crisscross. The individual's mechanism of attraction is the aura in which he lives and moves. It is a record of all impressions, both objective and subjective. It is the aura which predominantly creates the effects a person has on his associates. It is where our thoughts take up residence for better or worse. The following plates are a sampling of auras from Man Visible and Invisible by C.W. Ledbetter. Many of you are familiar with this book. These colored plates were painted as Ledbetter clairvoyantly described each aura to the artist. The first plate shows average man. Mostly it's just an acrid color with no delineated areas of development. The next plate is a strong shell of selfishness that represents the soul's immersion into matter. The next plate is intense anger. This shows focused malice and ill will. He defiles his whole astral body as he seeks vengeance on his enemy. Anyone near during the expression of this rage has damage inflicted upon their astral bodies. They are pierced psychically by these lightning bolts sent forth to destroy. The object of his anger receives the brunt of these destructive bolts of malice. In the next plate, we see the effect of fear. This represents a sudden shock of terror. The aura is infused in a livid gray mist with horizontal lines of the same hue that are vibrating so violently that to the clairvoyant, they are hardly recognizable as separate lines. Ledbetter describes this aura as ghastly and difficult to convey the idea of it by illustration. He observes that it appears in a strange way in which all light fades out for a time from the body and the whole gray mass quivers helplessly like a jelly. This type of deadly panic soon passes away. However, a condition of permanent fear or extreme nervousness maintains a peculiar tinge of gray in the characteristic quiver. In this aura, expressing irritation, a broad band of scarlet is a prominent feature. The floating flecks of scarlet are seen throughout the astral body, an indication of reactiveness to every little brush with worry, impatience, intolerance, or any other uncontrolled feeling. These flecks of annoyance can fly outward toward the person who is supposed to be responsible for the offense, but otherwise remain floating in the aura. They remain on call for the next little annoyance, for the irritable man is magnetically drawing them to him. In the plate representing affection, we see a sudden wave of strong and pure affection sweeping over a person. The coils or vortices become projectiles sent to the object of affection. In this way, Ledbetter explains that we give something of ourself, that a certain portion of astral matter passes from us to the loved one, charged so strongly with its own special rate of vibration that it sets the astral body of the receiver swinging in harmony with it. This magnetic attraction strengthens this bond with each expression of affection. Here is the aura of an ordinary devotional type. His character is represented by his colors. A touch of violet implies possible response to a high ideal. Blue shows a strong religious feeling with a small portion of the pure light blue of unselfish devotion. The small amount of yellow shows a very little intelligence for directing his devotion into reasonable channels. The red shows affection and adaptability mixed with deceit and selfishness. There is a vagueness of outline and no clear lines of demarcation. This expresses the vagueness of the devotional man's conceptions. In contrast, the next plate representing the scientific type lacks any sign of devotion, indicates an average amount of sensuality with the intellect developed to an abnormal degree. Affection and adaptability are small and of poor quality, overshadowed by the intellectual development. A good deal of selfishness, avarice, and a certain capability for jealousy is present. This represents an individual focused on the attainment of knowledge. In this next plate, we see a representation of the developed man. Here is the man who expresses the treasures of spirit in an evenly balanced manner. He is a seeker after the higher truth and has risen above earthly aims. His aura is now filled with many beautiful colors. Through the iridescent film can be seen the refined colors typifying the higher forms of love and devotion and an intellect refined and spiritualized by aspiration to the divine. The disciple eventually becomes a magnetic center of light, love, and wisdom as he learns to hold this magnetic aura in a state of receptivity. He becomes a channel for a higher range of impressions which he relays, grounding them in his environment and sphere of influence. In this way, the disciple becomes an outpost of God's love on earth. What appears to us as choice becomes an obligation under the law of magnetism. This last plate illustrates the radiating glory of God's love through the causal body of the adept. It is a demonstration of the perfect expression of the law of magnetism.
Good. Any questions for Rose? All right. Bill.
What's the name of the book all those plates came from?
Man, Visible.
What's the name of that book?
It's Man, Visible and Invisible.
Okay, thank you.
And actually, I believe it's probably out of print, but you can get it online. It's actually just on the web, the whole book.
Okay, yeah, thank you.
Okay, Bill, you're up. The Law of Vibration.
He's moving to a seat out of the mind.
Okay.
I'm pleased that that I'm coming toward the end because the law of vibration is very clear. Thank you for helping me get some of the sources together. Time on other things. But the law of vibration, this is the law of the first plane that covers all the atomic subplanes of each plane. It marks the beginning of the work of the Lotus. On each plane, the vibration of the atomic subplane sets in motion the matter of that plane. It is a key measure to sum up the significance of this law in the word light or fire. Is the law of fire. It governs the transportation of differentiated colors back into their systems. It controls the breaking up of the one into the seven and then the reabsorption back into the one. It is really the basic law of evolution, which necessitates evolution. It is a kind of water. It is acknowledged confidence. Acknowledges the first movement, the Logos made to express himself in this solar system. He uttered the sound, a threefold sound, one sound for each of the three systems, and started a ripple on every space. The sound grows in volume as time progresses, and when it has reached its full volume, when it is fully completed, it forms one of the notes from a major cosmic chord. Each note has six subtones, which first make the seventh. The law of their vibration, therefore, comprises 18 lesser vibrations of three makes the necessary 18, which is a key number of our own system. Our two multiplied by nine makes the necessary 18, which is a key number of our levels. 27 holds it. Won't get the mystery of the third system. On the path of evolution, this law controls the positive aspect of the process, follows rhythm and movement. And when all that involves in each plane, it makes a vibration of the atomic subplane that the goal brings. Therefore, we achieve the first main vibration and have perfected the vehicle for all evolutions, not during the evolution. A five-fold atomic subplane matter, we get the round of evolution in the system. Coming system, which I have two vibrations at the scale and then I'll this one that I'm completed in building. The law of vibration is the law of progress of movement and of polarization. On the seventh of those plane, the vibration is slow and longer, but larger from the standpoint of the first. He is learning how to vibrate or rotate or rotate. Second system on five names of humanity. Human evolution, you have five years, physical, astral, mental, and active. It all has to be verified, intensified, and refined. And the aim of evolution for us is love. The aim of evolution for us. process of love that was dominated by intelligence, where intelligence dominated by love for the end, for the interaction. The human race came into the scene as one of the natural bodies with their natural suffering. It's a pure analogy to the coming into the fourth or fifth race of more advanced people. Then in the treatise on the seven rays, I encountered some that I think was very interesting in terms of the group work that has to do with the law of group progress. And it's the law of evolution and symbolism out of the code. It's progressive energy, seventh grade factor of evolution. This law begins to function and be registered in the personal consciousness when the aspect of the certain method and goes in a certain field as back to this experience. It might be this in a very simple way to put the method into the supposed it would be well addressed as fact that the simple formulation of requirements of even the aspect of the consciousness demonstrates the outer and veiled reaction of the mind in some deeply esoteric cognitive truths. This statement contains the very essence of that esoteric knowledge. The disciple and training work. Was a field of the very practice of the faculty of discrimination. We have that sort of herb, the visual normal interpretation, we have this practice. It's decided to distinguish between the pairs of officers. And just as a new disciple, in early training discovered that the discriminating process has not to do with the choice between right and not rules of all the that concerns more of the subtle pairs of offices, such as right, wrong, silences, or the wrong speech, right understanding and right indifference in their offices. So that the man, on having a human, who is performing good at that, his higher evolves, discovered this discrimination, and it's still more subtle. That's where the probably athletes in the world today still mean this type of discrimination is not even being evoked. Relation to the following subtle contact. And these are the ones that, make the overview of our work. And I have the vibration of the soul itself, the vibration of the inner room even if unconsciously, are affiliated, the vibration of the master of the group. His ray vibration is emphasized as soul and master. And our vibration resulting from the interplay between the soul and his personality. The three different vibrations of his vital body, his organic body, and mind. Vibration, the vibration of the groups, of the group which he must work on the outer plane. The soul vibration of the people within mind contact. Vibration of such a group is an improvable world seven server. And I added a 10th that the vibration of all the group. Basically, this is we're moving from an intellect to the intuition, an armored response to spirit. And then this is the higher form of consciousness. It's angel life and time. In about paragraphs, we have a simple summary of some of the significance of this whole definition of this movement.
Oh. All right, good. Any questions for Bill? Let's thank you, Bill, and let's go on to Ann, who's going to talk to us about the law of fixation.
Okay, when I first Googled the law of fixation, I didn't get Alice Bailey. I'll get to what I got from Alice Bailey later, but I got fixation from the field of psychology, the state in which an individual becomes obsessed with an attachment to another human, animal, or an object. then, yes, that involves vision, maintaining gaze in a constant direction. The business law, it refers to a company's reluctance to change to suit current market conditions, and thus increasing the probability that the company will make larger numbers of greater severities of poor decisions. Fixation in law refers to works entitled to copyright protection, such as music, literature, and painting. Only the works mixed in a medium can be copyrighted, not the ideas behind those works of magazines. Online marketing fixation on online eye tracking refers to the subject fixing on a particular portion of the page. This is used to determine which areas of a web page receive the most views. This is used to test where content resides on a web page to maximize its exposure. Then I got into the alphabet of books. And esoteric psychology, too. I got the following. There are three major laws. The law of the law of economy, which is baseball. The law of attraction, which is involved the soul aspect, the atom of the solar system. Then the law of synthesis governs man at initiation. It said that the law of fixation is one of seven minor laws which produced the evolutionary the first thing of man and the soul. The seven laws concern the form side of life. And by means of the law of fixation, the mind controls and stabilizes. Then from the rays of the initiation, from the rays and initiations, I got fixation is not permitted to the internal. It's not permitted to the internal pilgrim upon our little planet Earth, but when that is left behind entirely, at the ninth initiation, the initiate becomes a fixed or stationary point of light in his chosen place, the place of the Most High and the point of fire upon the mountaintop. From that point, he will no longer go out. Then I tried. I couldn't find, let's see, this on Cosmic Fire in our library, but I tried Googling Alice Bailey and the Law of Fixation. And I was very surprised that Alice Bailey came up on Google. The Law of Fixation is the governing law of the mental plane, binding it to greater correspondence to the Law of Karma on cosmic mental levels. As a man thinks, so is he. According to his thoughts are his desires and acts, and so results the future. This is for himself the resultant karma. The word fixation is chosen for two purposes. First, because the word implies the capacity of the mender to shape his own destiny, and secondly, because the word implies a stabilizing idea for evolution. For as evolution progresses, the ego evolves the faculty of forming definite concrete thought forms and into stable products of subduing the fluctuations of the astral body. Just something that I wondered about was when we meditate and we hold ourselves steady in the light of an idea. Are we then using any concept of fixation?
Absolutely. That's a good insight. The process of concentration is a technique of fixation. We recognize flux and change here on the physical plane, reactiveness in the emotions. It's the mind with its capacity to fix on a point, that point being our identity, point of light within the mind of God. We find our source and we find our point of fixation. By the same token, everything we've talked about in terms of Aristotle and the ethics, the power of the ethics is it allows us to utilize the law of fixation to make judgments and establish priorities about our life. Good. Very good. Anybody have any questions for Anne? Then let's go on. Thank you, Anne. And let's go on to Betty and talking about the law of analogy.
Is this where I say the cat ate my arm?
It could be. Does the cat have a fur ball?
Well, she does get fascinated. When the printer starts printing out things, she does get fascinated with that.
Well, if that's the case, if you're printing out something from your computer, the cat may have eaten your homework, but you still have it on your computer. And you could print it out again.
Okay. The law of analogy is the universe's process of connecting things. Traces of spirit can be found in all matter. All living matter is meant to fit these pieces together in an effort to reflect God or heaven as best it can within the limitations of earthly existence. The word analogy traces its origins back to the Greek word analogia, meaning proportional. Analogy is the process of transferring information or meaning from a source or analog to a target or subject. It may describe the relationship between the source and the target. The law of analogy is also known as the law of correspondences, which is summed up in the esoteric statement, as above, so below. While my life on earth often seems a dim mirror for cosmic truths, we do the best we can to make sense of life in the physical plane and trace our way back to spirit by comparing things and drawing conclusions from those comparisons. The law of analogy tells us that we reflect God's light or heaven, whether we realize it or not. Analogy is also known as the law of affinity. We seek to identify with other members of our race because people need other people, to quote the lyrics from a once popular Barbra Streisand song. In his essay, Great Men, Emerson tells us that the possibility of interpretation lies in the identity of the observer with the observed. Life can only be known by life. The reason he knows about them is that he is of them. Their quality makes his career, and he can variously publish of their virtues because they compose him. The quest to find our proper place within the tribe leads us to look for characteristics, experiences, and ideals that we have in common with other humans. This motivates formations of sports teams, music groups, civic organizations, faith communities. At the highest level, it also refers to our identification with interplanes, ashrams. At the lowest levels, jealousy, competitiveness, the desire to control others, corrupt and distract us from proper uses of the law of affinity. The earthly groups formed in this way include street gangs or politically corrupt mafia organizations. If we admire something about a person or group, we might seek to alter our lifestyle to be more like that person. At a noble level, we might be inspired by the example of a loving parent, a wise teacher. At the opposite end of the scale, we observe the silliness of young people who seek to copy the clothing and hairstyles of successful entertainment icons, such as Justin Bieber or Lady Gaga. When left to their own untrained devices, children make comparisons that are often deeply flawed and could be harmful. Consider the young boy eager to experiment with the family car, who tells his father, "Johnny's dad lets him drive the car by itself." For the case of an adolescent daughter who seeks acceptance among her schoolmates and tells her mother, "All the other kids are going to the party." If you don't let me go, I'll die of embarrassment, and you will be the most horrible mother in the whole world. What the young would-be car driver failed to mention is that Johnny's situation is supervised. He lives on a farm where he drives through the fields in a cast-off bunker, moving at less than 10 miles per hour, to carry water, food, and supplies to workers who are chopping wood and mending fences. The wise father knows that, of course, and tells his son, you're welcome to go live with John in Johnny's house and drive with him if his parents were happy. In denying her daughter's wish to attend the party, the equally well-informed mother understands that the gathering her daughter wants to attend will be an unsupervised affair where there's apt to be drinking, drugs, and sexual promiscuity. The behavior of these so-called friends is not what a wise and loving mother wants her daughter to identify with. In turning down the request, the mother offers her daughter a higher correspondence. You can have your own get-together here on Saturday. Invite two or three friends. Make a sleepover if you like. Our understanding of spirit is often narrow. Our lives on earth are imperfect, and therefore our analogies are never exact in detail or scope. Analogies reflect as much truth as they can within the limitations of existing circumstances and understanding of the people drawing the analogies. The parables of Jesus provide some of the purest analogies available. He told his followers that the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, which a man took and planted in his field. The kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field. The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed in 60 pounds of flour until it worked all through the dough. St. Matthew's Gospel has 8 such parables. Jesus was a master who used the comparisons to give people glimpses into the highest life of God that we are meant to emulate. Over 2,000 years later, these analogies continue as powerful sources of enlightenment for Christianity.
Good. Any comments, questions for Betty?
Thank you for all your examples, Betty. Yeah, I didn't do things. I realized as people were reciting it, I didn't take the same approach that other people took. And I don't.
You had a different assignment. All righty, we have one more presentation, unless I've skipped somebody. Dorothy, talking about the law of inward parts.
Yes, the law of inward parts, and I took a little different approach as well. I was struggling a little bit finding and challenging to find information at first, and I took some time to ponder the information I found, and I tried to observe it as well in people, animals, plant life, and so on. And then I was inspired by Robert Browning's poem we studied on Tuesday, Old Pictures in Florence. So here's my little presentation.
Okay.
Unseen Pictures in Baltimore, or What the Law of the Inward Parts Means to Me. I looked and pondered, found not in DK, but in the Bible and the story of God. The meaning presents two roles, they say. Substance and essence, let us apply. Substance is known in general as form. Essence can be described as a soul. They were splendid when they were born. They are more perfect as they reach their goal. The morn, when first it glowed today, the oriole gives a whistle in the tree. On the porch, I inhale the beauty of the rose bouquet and listen to the buzzing bee. Returned from Colorado with mountains, majesty, still in awe of Black Canyon of the Gunnison, the royal throne of Maryland's eastern shore, I do curtsy and proclaim it's time to go down the ocean hunt. But first, how to inspire lifelong learning to enjoy at your library, classical music, or art exhibit, or dancing star. Now evening, little neighbor John smiles his joy. Laptop, lunch bag, books, files, I unload the car. When worry and fear are harnessed each day, the inner light of spirit grows closer to the whole. The but this hope reflects the invisible one cannot gainsay. The personality is in tune with the soul.
Good.
That's it.
That's very good. Any questions for Dorothy? All right. Well, that's. Did I overlook anybody? This is your. I don't think so. Those are all excellent presentations. I thank you for your hard work and your effort and your delivery of these words of wisdom and insight. You all did a good job. I'm very impressed. I thank you all for an excellent class, and we'll do it again, I'm sure, in the future. Thank you so much.